Support for WPR comes from Becca Kate's Kitchen, Kids and Home in downtown Baraboo, offering gourmet cookware, specialty gadgets, and bridal registry. More at BEKAHKates.com.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Great to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. You know, spring is kind of right around the corner, and this is the perfect time, I think, to dream about changes to your landscape. And we have someone who knows a lot about that with us today on the show, Katie Tammany. She is the Chief Marketing Officer at Monrovia Growers of Plants, Trees, and Shrubs. She serves as the company's chief storyteller and trend spotter. She has more than 25 years of expertise in lifestyle and leisure activities, former editor of Sunset Magazine, and she's a longtime and very avid gardener. She has a specific interest in the connections between garden, art, health, and well-being. And I know it's going to be a fun conversation. As we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about gardening trends? Are you looking for some new varieties of plants for your landscape? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to talk@WPR.org. Katie Tammany, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Good morning, Larry, and all the gardeners out there. Excited to be here.
I think most of us have seen that the very distinctive Monrovia container at one gardening center or another. And I think it'd be fun to learn about the history and background of the company. How to get started and tell us its history a bit.
Sure. Monrovia will celebrate its 100th birthday in 2026. We have been around a while. The company started by a man, Harry Rosedale, who started the company in Southern California with 40 acres. And he really created the idea of growing shrubs and trees in containers to ship to garden centers. Before Harry, nurseries used to just plant shrubs and trees actually in the ground and kind of rip them out, put them in a pot and ship them. And Harry was the guy that figured out, you know, I think that's kind of hard on the plants. Maybe we should start them in a container. He actually was a pioneer in many aspects of the horticulture industry. He started patenting plants. He recognized that not every rose is the same, not every, you know, lavender is the same. And he sought to grow the best varieties that average gardeners could do really well with. And his other, I think, claim to fame, and it's something that we practice today, is that, you know, a healthy plant really starts with healthy roots. And so he invested a lot of research into understanding what really creates healthy roots in the garden, starting with soil. So we custom blend our soils to suit the needs of each plant that we grow. And then we add a beneficial fungus called mycorrhizae that helps the plant's roots establish themselves more quickly in the garden once planted. So he did a lot of research on every aspect of plant growth.
And a pretty broad variety of plants that you market and sell.
Yes, I think that's one of the more unusual things about Monrovia as a grower. We grow, 4,000 varieties, everything from houseplants and annuals to edibles and trees. We work with breeders from around the world. We work with plant explorers, too, from around the world, bringing back plants from, you know, North India and China that are climate appropriate for the U.S. And then we also we discover a lot of new plants actually at our own nurseries. You know, we've got really observant craftsmen who will spot when a plant develops a sport, you know, something in a new color. And we've created actually some really wonderful cultivars from our nurseries through our craftsmen.
It's a really cool and locations all over, kind of all over the world in a way, right?
Well, yeah,
as you were saying,
we have nurseries in Oregon, in California, in Georgia, and Connecticut. So we're able to trial and test plants in, you know, every climate to make sure that, you know, they're going to grow where we ship them.
Now, a gardener can't buy directly from Monrovia, but how can they find the plants that we're going to be talking about today?
So we sell our plants through independent garden centers around the country. So your local, you know, just your local garden center is probably, you know, a best choice. And then also we sell to Lowe's stores. But those are the only two places you can find Monrovia plants.
You have a great website. Talk about some of the tools that are available on that site before we go to the phones.
Sure. That's another wonderful thing that we pioneered, actually, is creating a plant database for gardeners and landscape professionals. The database is pretty robust, and there are a couple of tools that make it easy to find the plant that would fit well in your garden. One is called My Plant Finder, and you just click on the top, you know, nav bar on the site, and you fill in, you know, your zone or zip code if you don't know your zone, and then you can filter the selection by, you know, sun exposure, by your soil type. Maybe you're looking for a screening hedge, and then you can quickly see what plants we grow that would fit your needs. That's probably our most popular tool. We also have planting plans. If you, you know, are stuck on, you know, don't know how to design your patio area, a container, a pathway, we've got lots of plans to help you do that.
Let's take a call. Kat in Mazamani has something for us. Kat, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello. I was wondering if she could talk a bit about the difference between natives and nativars, and whether nativars provide the same benefits to insects and birds that natives do.
Yeah.
Wow, great question, and one that is a very intense topic right now in the horticulture community. Nativars, for those that are not familiar with that term, are, you know, cultivars of a native plant, you know, something that, you know, we might be like an adjustment to a native. I think that a lot of people who are maybe newer to gardening think that, you know, something's either native or it's invasive. And, you know, to do the right thing for the environment, you want to only plant natives. And that is not the case. I mean, it's not as if there's just, you know, A or B. Nativars can be great choices for pollinators. They can be great choices for a climate appropriate garden. But it's not the same thing as an invasive plant. So I just wanted to, you know, make sure that was clear. We believe that the best thing you can do for the environment, for pollinators, for insects, is to grow a very diverse mix in the garden. And that includes natives, absolutely. But if you only grow natives in your garden, I think you're going to sometimes find that the natives are harder to maintain. They can get more robust, let's say. They can grow bigger in a home garden than out in the wild, and they can also have, you know, respects they can have limited bloom time. So keeping your garden full of blooms longer means that you probably want to plant a mix of natives and nativars.
All right, Kat, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. In a way, I think our caller was zeroing a little bit on trends, and let's talk about trends for 2025. How do you decide what's trending or know what's trending?
Monrovia does a lot of research, we'll start there, with homeowners across the U.S. We do a really deep survey every summer, really asking people about their gardening challenges, their wishes, what, you know, what their problems are that they're trying to solve, what they purchased last year, what they plan to purchase in the future. And then we also do ongoing research throughout the year related to particular plant categories. And then I think some of our trend spotting is based on our team's years of experience, looking at what's, you know, out there trending on social media, other types of media, talking to professionals in the industry. And we publish a set of usually four or five, what we see as the leading macro trends for the next year. For 2025, some of the things that we've spotted based on this research are a trend that we call green drenching, where homeowners are really layering more green in their gardens to create a feeling of calm, to create a relaxing space, and they're wanting to cover fences, let's say, with screening hedges. They're wanting to plant more ferns, more larger leafed plants in the landscape, really using different shades of green to create a feeling of calm. You know, one of the things that we started asking actually during the pandemic was we were asking questions of homeowners trying to understand, you know, motivations for garden related to wellness. And what we have seen in the last 4 to 5 years is the connection people are making between gardening and de-stressing and feeling positive. That's just growing every year. Last year, gardeners reported 45% of gardeners told us that gardening helps me feel more positive and it takes my mind off of the stress of everyday life, off of, you know, stressful, you know, news, and planting and working outside helps me feel energized and rejuvenated. And that number keeps climbing. When we first asked it 4 to 5 years ago, it was like, you know, 35%. It keeps going up. And that's true for all ages, you know, all levels of gardening, that connection that we're making to, you know, being out in nature and feeling better is just growing.
Oh, our guest today, Katie Tammany, the Chief Marketing Officer at Monrovia, taking a look at garden trends for 2025 with her, and also talking about plants. She's got some suggestions and recommendations for some new plants and other plants that they've been working on. I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Or email us to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks for joining in to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Katie Tammany of Monrovia. She's the Chief Marketing Officer at Monrovia, serves as the company's trend spotter and chief storyteller. So it's great to have her with us. She's lots of gardening experience. And I hope you'll join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I wanted to talk about that. One of the trends was the modern meadow.
Yeah, right. So
explain what that is all about.
Sure. So getting back to the question we had earlier about natives and nativars, we've seen an interest in a more natural looking landscape, natural approach to gardening. And, you know, considering the front yard, thinking about making it look more like a meadow, a natural meadow. And so an interest in looking at compact, sort of well-behaved grasses mixed with perennials in the garden gives you, you know, a great pollinator habitat, gives you a more carefree looking front yard. And I'd like to recommend a grass that I think does, you know, particularly well in most areas of Wisconsin, and that's Jazz Little Bluestem. It's a newer grass for us. It's super hardy, doesn't flop, hardy down to zone 3. The foliage gets this really pretty purple hue in the fall, which makes it a great match for a lot of perennials. And it can take various types of soil, including clay. It's got good drought tolerance once established, which I know drought is an increasing concern for a lot of gardeners that didn't have to deal with it before. It's just a beautiful little grass, mixed with perennials such as echinacea, I think it would be a great choice.
Oh, wonderful. We've got an email. This is a totally different area, but email from Carol in Green Bay, who had a terrible problem with in relating to her hostas. She has slugs are destroying her hostas and did last summer. She has lots of shade, so hostas are ideal, among the ideal. Is there a way to get rid of the slugs, or do you have other suggestions for other kinds of shade plants that would work for her?
Yeah. I hear you. I feel like slugs are the salad buffet the hostas are the salad buffet for slugs often. I would recommend, in terms of slug control where you are, really going to your local garden center for advice. But if you're looking for a plant that might do well in the shade, is a better choice. I think, where I am, it's ferns. I'm going to have to do some quick research about what would do well in zone 5 for you in the shade. But the other suggestion I would make is to go on Plant Finder on Monrovia.com and punch in your zone, punch in shade. You're looking for, ground cover foliage. And that's a great way to see the choices there.
Yeah, we've got a fairly broad range of zonal range. I think it runs from 3B to, I see Madison's 5A. I think there's even to 6A. So we've got a fairly good range there. But that's a good idea to go to the website. You can get some very specific, Monrovia website, you can get some pretty specific information. Gary in Madison has a question. Hi, Gary.
Hi. For the first time, I'm going to start growing some of my own flowers this year. And I've never done that before. But anyway, somebody told me that I will never get the flowers to be nice and big like I see at the different places that sell flowers, because those growers use something called plugs and not seeds. Is that true?
Okay, so Gary's a first-timer here.
Right. No, I don't. That's not true. I mean, we start with, you could call it liners or plugs. That's just actually a cutting from a plant that you get rooted, get started. And a plug just means the tray that a grower is using. So if you take a cutting off of a plant that has really robust flowers, you're going to get, another plant with really robust flowers, but it doesn't really make a difference whether something starts with seed or plug in terms of the flower size you get. But while we're talking about flowers, I'd like to talk a bit about hydrangeas and some really great options for hydrangeas that make excellent cut flowers. We have a hydrangea series called Seaside Serenade that stays about 3 to 4 feet tall, and it was actually bred for the cut flower market. So the stems are really strong, won't flop over. It's got really good leaves too, like tougher leaves. The blooms, when you cut them off the plant, really stand up for a long time. And it comes in really beautiful colors, dark, bold, purples and really intense pinks and reds. And that's another key trend that we're seeing for next year is bold color in flowers. So I feel like there's a lot of great choices out there, and not just in hydrangeas, but other flowers in that bold, beautiful look.
And somebody's going to say, oh, wait a minute, I didn't get the name of that hydrangea. What is that name?
So the Seaside Serenade hydrangea, there's actually 9 in the collection. So you can see all of them on our website. They come in a range of fantastic colors.
I went online and I looked at those, and they are really beautiful. And Gary, if you wanted to make your own plugs, you could also get flower seeds and start your own seeds indoors and get a head start on it so that they're ready to go later on. Now there's we'll probably not go into all of that today on the show, But certainly there's a lot of help for that. And getting started with your own seeds, you can certainly do that in your own plug. Make your own plugs if you want to. Thank you very much for calling. Lanny in Shenanigan Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Lanny.
Hello, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I know I'm just a retired gentleman here. I'm originally from Cincinnati, Ohio, and I moved up to Wisconsin because I love it up here. And I just wanted to comment and to say that, you know, gardening is very healing. You know, I mean, that's all I can say is very healing, and it's very optimistic, and it's very cool. So I think gardening is a good way to enjoy your retirement because you can get into other people. You can get into conversations. You don't have to be closed out away from civilization. You know, gardening is a good open up thing to communicate with other people, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, it's just real positive, and I enjoy your show, Larry. And I just got finished moving, so I'm trying to settle down from moving, and I'm not going to move anymore. So anyway.
Lanny, thank you so much for calling. Well, Katie, I don't think you're going to be arguing with Lanny.
No, I love that comment, and I so agree with it. And I think, you know, gardening also feeds your curiosity. It keeps you curious about not just about plants, but, you know, other people and ways of doing things. It's constant learning. It is very healing. I love that. I think one of the other trends, Larry, that sort of fits in with that, besides the green drenching I was talking about earlier, is what we call the garden of abundance. The idea that you can plant, you know, your edibles don't have to be in one section of your garden. You can weave in what we call edible perennials, you know, edible shrubs and herbs. You can weave them into the landscape because they're really quite beautiful. And there's a blackberry, for instance, a superlicious blackberry that is, it's a thornless dwarf blackberry, puts on an incredible fireworks show of berries in the summer, stays about 3 to 4 feet tall, and it would be beautiful mixed in as a low hedge with hydrangeas, for instance. And so thinking about mixing in those edibles into the garden so that as you're strolling in the garden, you can reach down for a snack, you know, as you're clipping or pruning your other plants. It's really that's a joyful, really wonderful thing to do.
And Lanny, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I was really surprised to see a strawberry plant on your list of flowers for the meadow.
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, you can plant edibles in the meadow, the modern meadow.
It surprised me a little bit. I think it was an Eversweet, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that idea of growing a diverse range of plants in that modern meadow, you know, massing, maybe you mass a few berries in one part of the meadow and then you, you know, you mass some other colorful, you know, you could mass some agastache or some fuchsia, some other perennials. You know, one of the things that we're also seeing with interest in pollinators these days is the real interest in hummingbirds, mm-hmm. and attracting hummingbirds to your garden space. We kind of call the hummingbird the glamour pollinator. it's a pollinator that, you know, people want to see visit the garden, and so having a mix of, you know, a mass of a flowering perennial of one type with a lot of nectar. That's really good for hummingbirds because they have such a fast metabolism. They want to, you know, sort of poke around one plant and feed for a little bit of time. That's a great thing that you can weave into the modern meadow.
And the another one, and I'm not sure if you mentioned it yet, was the evolution, the colorific. Cornflower.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah,
when
yeah.
you mentioned pollinators, I thought of that one.
Yeah, so that echinacea is really unusual. It emerges, the flower emerges kind of green and then turns pink and then turns sort of an apricot orange. So you have on one plant, you have a multiple hues in the blooms. It stays really nice and robust, doesn't get too tall, doesn't flop over. It's really sturdy. It's a very sturdy echinacea. Beautiful choice. And we've been growing that for a little bit of time. I thought when you were saying evolution, I also wanted to mention hydrangea early evolution, which is kind of an unusual panicle hydrangea, blooms super early. You'll get that in spring. You'll get the blooms in spring. And it stays nice and compact. It's only 2 feet tall. And it's just covered in blooms. It gets this really pretty sort of white pink bloom on it. That's been a hydrangea that we've really seen incredible popularity in the last year or so, especially in Wisconsin.
And what was that name again?
That is called hydrangea early evolution.
Hydrangea early evolution. You know, one of the segments or on your website that I really enjoyed was the area of plants that add bold color, and you did mention one earlier, the Seaside Serenade. But
yeah.
I was taken with the Panama Red.
Oh, the coneflower, yeah.
Coneflower.
Yeah, the echinacea. Yeah, we grow many, many different kinds of echinacea. And breeders have been really working at increasing the intensity of the shades and the blooms, and the Panama Red is just gorgeous. I think the other thing going on in breeding of echinaceas that's interesting is a lot more layering in the petals. So you get like this really sort of lush looking bloom. We have a new series called Sunseekers Echinacea, where it almost looks like a zinnia. It's really, quite lush and bold. So lots of choices out there now. Again, sort of veering toward the echinaceas that stay a little more compact and robust and don't get quite so tall.
And even peonies, I saw, what was it called? Garden Candy, I guess.
Yeah. The Garden Candy series, you get more than one bloom off of a stem. And with gorgeous, gorgeous colors, you know, a real sort of true red, vibrant pink, but more blooms. And I think that one of the unusual things about the way Monrovia grows peonies is we keep our peonies growing at the nursery for longer, so that when you buy a Monrovia peony, it's going to bloom that first year. Sometimes you'll buy a peony, you have to wait a while, but the first spring that you get a peony from Monrovia, it's going to bloom. And the Garden Candy series, it's really the multiple blooms on one stem that's exciting.
And let's go to that other trend that you had mentioned. I didn't want to go back to it. The Garden of Abundance. Is this about creating and maintaining an entire ecosystem within the garden? Sounds like it.
Yeah, you know, and I think as we get into gardening, oftentimes we think of it as our own, just little paradise where we want to have it be productive and beautiful, and we want to see bird life and pollinators come visit. We want it all. That's why it's called the Garden of Abundance. And I want to talk a bit about, too, some really pretty flowering shrubs in that Garden of Abundance that would be good to mix with some of the other, fruit I was referring to earlier. We have a Rose of Sharon series called the Chateau series, and that's another unique option. It's zone 5, and it gets blooms covering the stems, so you get this incredibly florific look in your Chateau of and in your Rose of Sharon. And it comes in beautiful shades, like sort of a lilac color, pink. That would make a great anchor in this garden of abundance. I mentioned the blackberry earlier, another great choice. We've got, you know, apple trees and of course, fig trees. I think our hardiest fig probably goes to zone six.
In terms of the apples, though, I was intrigued by the fruit snacks, Blushing Delight.
Yeah.
Describe that, because that sounded like it might fit in kind of a smaller area, quote smaller, but.
Yeah, no, that's the idea behind the fruit snack series. What a great name that is for these series of fruit trees. So they're apple trees that grow about 6 to 8 feet tall and stay 2 to 3 feet wide. So you can have several in a pretty small space. They won't get really tall or wide. And they actually, you know, have a lot of fruit, and they don't need as much spraying, you know, too. It's, you know, again, a new development and breeding that we're pretty excited about. We just started offering the fruit snack series last year. So they're still in sort of limited supply, but ask your local garden center to order one for you.
Yeah, I think, what did you say? It's about 2 feet wide is all. Yeah. It's really columnar, and then it gets maybe 10 feet tall.
Yeah, it's pretty great. It's perfect for our smaller yard spaces, you know, and I think, you know, we're interested as we think about growing plants in the future. We're really interested in edibles too, that you can grow in containers that you know, you can really fit into more growth in a smaller space.
Gail is on her way up north. Called from the car, couldn't stay with us, but she called to say she's in zone four.
Uh-huh.
And hasn't been able to overwinter her Shasta daisies. Do you have a suggestion for a variety that might be tougher?
I'm just going to do a quick...
Yeah, go ahead.
Look at... if we want to get...
Shastas should grow in zone four.
We have one called Shortstop. Shortstop Shasta should do well in zone four. I would recommend that, or one called Lemon Puff is another one. Lemon Puff is a little more lush, you know, has the sort of layering of yellow petals. It's tighter and lower. I think that either Lemon Puff or Shortstop might be.
What is Shortstop like?
Shortstop looks more like, the bloom looks more like a traditional Shasta daisy, but it stays more compact.
Oh, Brian in Appleton, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Brian.
Hi there. Yeah, just a quick question about, you might not be able to answer it, but those shorter apple trees you were just talking about?
Yeah.
I've been buying scion wood of a couple different apple trees. Would the scion wood still kind of keep the shorter height of the tree?
That is beyond my expertise, I'm sorry to say.
Can't help you out there, Brian. I'm sorry we can't, but it's beyond me a little bit too. So there you go.
Sorry, Brian. But I would suggest talking to your, you know, local extension or local garden center for insight.
It's something we can bring up on another one of our Garden Talk shows down the road, Brian. So stay listening. I'll keep that in the back of my my mind for bringing up and talking about in another version of the program. How many varieties do you guys grow?
Just about 4,000 varieties total, yeah.
And where do you ship?
We ship all over the U.S. and into Canada, and I bef- Yeah, I wanted to talk about our roses while we're talking about, you know, what grows everywhere that we grow at all of our nurseries. We have several new roses that I think, you know, even if you thought you didn't like roses, I'd like to suggest a few that may make you reconsider that. So we have a new series called Seaside Swirl Rugosa Roses. These are Zone 3 hardy. One of the things that's different about the Seaside Swirl Rose series is that they stay more compact than other rugosas. They don't get quite so crazy. And, you know, full of blooms. They get these really lovely rose hips, and they come in those bright, bold colors I was talking about before. We also have some other beautiful, compact, stay bushy, but really compact. We have a rose called Itsy Bitsy Peach that only gets about 2 feet tall. Makes a great container choice. Nitty Gritty Rose is a great kind of carpet type ground cover rose, just full of blooms, comes in a lot of beautiful colors. And these are all Monrovia exclusive roses. So definitely.
Are they full sun types or?
Yes. Yeah. Full sun and own root, disease resistant, just fantastic choices. Like I said, if you think of roses as those taller canes, you know, more specimen type, these are different. These are ones to really consider as landscaping shrubs. So I just want to make sure that your listeners know about them.
Nathan had emailed to ask if you have any ideas for companion plants like the three sisters and vegetables.
Oh, yeah. Boy, that's a great question. We produce this Shades of Beautiful guide that does give you companion plants in the landscape. I think one of my, you know, favorites are, you know, when you mix the echinacea with the compact grasses, those do really well together. That's a great combo.
Katie, we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much. What's your what's the website address? We'll probably have it up on our page, but.
Well, thanks for asking, Larry. It's monrovia.com. Really easy to find.
Yeah, and there's a lot of information on the site. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This was great, and I wish everybody a fantastic spring of gardening.
Okay, Katie Tammany, Chief Marketing Officer at Monrovia. She serves as the company's chief storyteller and trendspotter. So it's great to have her with us. Coming up, we're going to take a look at potatoes, our most popular vegetable. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention for the next 45 minutes or so to growing potatoes. Pretty easy to do if you know the right steps. And we have somebody who knows the right steps for sure. You can grow some great potatoes if you take Amanda Gevin's advice. Amanda is the department chair of the Department of Plant Pathology at the UW-Madison. She's a professor. She's an extension specialist as well as the administrative director of the Wisconsin Seed Potato Certification Program. She is the Fritz Friday Chair for Vegetable Production Research. So as we talk with Amanda today, I hope you'll join in. What problems have you had with your potatoes? What questions are you looking for? A certain variety? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Amanda Gevin's, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How did you How'd you get interested in potatoes?
It's a great question. I grew up on the east end of Long Island, on the North Fork east end of Long Island, and that that had been, both the North and South Forks were home to thousands of acres of potato production through the 1940s, 50s, 60s. During my growing up, we did see a reduction in acreage there, but I saw them all around me and had a wonderful opportunity to work with Cornell Cooperative Extension in our county and learn a bit about how potatoes are produced. And in my work, I was able to assist with some of that production and looking at disease monitoring and insect pests in the crop over my high school and college years. So that's how I got interested. And then through the lens of plant pathology or disease research, I was able to come back to that crop and as well as other vegetable crops and work in the capacity of research and extension to bring information we learn about disease management to the growers. And that includes gardeners.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about my own experience back in the day when I was a young man and in summers and even on weekends in college, I worked for Armstrong Produce and we were the potato. I delivered potatoes all over Madison and I would oftentimes on the weekends, they'd plop me in a semi and I'd drive to central Wisconsin, and I would pick up 150, 100-pound bags of potatoes from a farmer and bring them right back to Armstrong Produce in Madison.
Oh, very interesting. What a neat connection, Larry.
Yeah, but potatoes, I mean, they've been cultivated forever, practically. I mean, going back 8,000 BC, something like that.
Yeah, certainly potato is a longstanding food crop and one that as it developed in Central America as a staple food crop, it certainly gained adoption around the world. I think where pathology comes in during the time of the Irish potato famine, there was that gave us strong recognition of the importance of diseases and the importance of clean seed in between the cropping cycles in order to maintain quality and levels of yield that were expected to feed families locally and for the marketplace to feed families beyond. So, yeah, certainly the importance of this crop globally has just continued to increase now as one of the top three staple food crops across the globe.
Yeah. Tom in Friendship has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. Great show, Larry, as always.
Thank you.
My question is, I've been growing red potatoes in central Wisconsin. There's a lot of potato fields around here, but I just have a little garden, and I've been getting scabs lately on the potatoes, but I've been holding my potatoes every year, like in a root cellar, and I'm thinking this year just to start all over with a different variety or just a like maybe red Pontiac. How does that sound?
Yes, that's a great question. So common scab is the name of this disease. We're not very creative in pathology. So if you've got it, it's probably the one that many have. And so it is caused by a bacterial pathogen, actually, called Streptomyces scabies. And that is a pathogen that it will accumulate on the seed potatoes, right? So, of course, the potato tubers that you harvest in one season, some of those it sounds like you've been holding over and using as your seed in the next cycle. And in doing that, one of the downsides of that, a couple of things happen with that. But one of them is you do begin to accumulate pathogen, right? And so common scab as a pathogen is in the soil. It's among the microbes that give us that lovely soil smell when we first turn over the soil in the spring. That those are Streptomyces that do that and make that smell. But if you note that a portion of those Streptomyces can be pathogenic to potato. So what to do? Many red varieties have susceptibility to common scab. But it sounds like your idea of maybe thinking of a different cultivar choice would be a good one. But I do think going back to buying some stock seed potatoes from a garden center where those potatoes that are sold as seed have a certification. And while the common scab pathogen is not one that we certify for in particular, it is a disease to be managed. And it's one that's managed very well by our seed potato producers here in Wisconsin and in other states. But I think that's the place to do it, is to limit that inoculum that you're putting back in the soil when you're planting. And so, yeah, get some new seed. If you want to choose a different red cultivar, I think that's a good thing to do. But other things you can do is make sure that you're watering evenly throughout the growing cycle. Once your tubers are beginning to form, that's typically a month and a half after you're planting, you'll start to form tubers. And it's from that point forward that you really want to make sure you're watering potatoes uniformly and don't let them get a real dry spell. If they have one of those dry spells, that's often the time at which we'll see more onset of common scab. And so keep that soil at a comfortable moisture level for potatoes. Don't let them get too dry. The other thing you can do is watch your pH. Scabs like it more basic. Check your soil. If it's higher than about 5.8, maybe think about an amendment to that soil to get your pH down a little bit lower, and that will help limit common scab.
All right. There you go, Tom. Thank you very much for calling. You mentioned certification. You know, you're tell us a bit about the Wisconsin and Wisconsin Seed Potato Certification Program. What's the benefit of that, and what does it do?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So our certification program is over 100 years old, and a partnership with our Seed Potato Improvement Association and our Department of Plant Pathology here in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. And what we do, we work with the seed producers in primarily they're in northern Wisconsin, in most abundantly Langlade County. But we maintain potato tissue culture because plants don't grow right now from true seed. So down on campus or just west of campus in Middleton at the Wisconsin Crop Innovation Center, we maintain small, tiny tissue culture plantlets of hundreds of varieties of potato. And then when it's time, we take those tissue culture plantlets, we scale them up, and we grow small potato tubers in a greenhouse up in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, where we have a early generation seed farm called our Lila Starks Seed Farm. And from there, those little potatoes, some are grown hydroponically, some varieties are grown in soil. We take those, and that becomes then the first generation of potato tubers as seed that are then grown in a foundation seed farm in the open field outside. And then that becomes generation one. And then those are sold to the next seed grower, early generation seed grower, that will grow them out for field generation 2, 3, 4. Typically we don't go much beyond field season 5. But each of those growth periods is a sort of a scaling up. When we think about a pyramid of tissue culture plantlets all the way to enough seed potatoes to generate in our state about 65,000 acres. But nonetheless, so that the process then is to observe those potato plants grown in field for our commercial seed potato growers. And we have field inspections, and then we have post-harvest testing. We have a subset of seed that actually travels all the way to Hawaii. And we have what we call the winter grow out that happens after Christmas and before New Year's. So the holiday, bit of a holiday for those seed potatoes to get to go to Hawaii. And we have a look at them there. They grow more rapidly. We can have a look to make sure that those plants don't have virus or other diseases or varietal mixtures that could concern the lot of seed. And then those data are brought back, and we make then the certification for those potatoes. Growers find out the status, and then they sell their seed to commercial producers. So that's the step to ensure quality and purity.
I'm glad I asked that question, because it's really, really a wonderful, wonderful program. And we can talk some more about that, but I want to get into how the home grower can do a good job with their potatoes as well. And we'll get to that. Amanda Gevins, department chair in the plant pathology department at UW-Madison, professor and extension specialist. And we'll be back with her right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here talking about growing potatoes on Garden Talk today with our guest Amanda Gevins, who is department chair of the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, professor and extension specialist, as well as administrative director of the Wisconsin Seed Potatoes Certification Program. As we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. I see we have a bunch of emails here already. And if you want a phone, you can do that too. Number's 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You know, Amanda, over the news break, I was thinking about John Shaneman. John Shaneman, UW professor of horticulture, developed a production and management program for russet Burbank potatoes in Wisconsin, and that became the leading variety of potatoes grown in our state. I remember interviewing John once, and he used to go around to restaurants, and if they advertised Idaho baking potatoes, he would always order it, but then he'd find out that they were really Burbanks, and he would... He would tell them that they should be not promoting something that they weren't really serving, and that Wisconsin potatoes obviously were just as good.
Russet Burbanks are still grown for processing here in our state and in many states here in the United States.
What are the favorite? That's all in way of just asking you, what are the varieties here that are doing well and grown in the state?
Yeah, that's a good question. The still for our fresh market or direct market sales, we still we do see some Bakers, and there are russet types, typically not russet Burbank in the fresh market space, but varieties like russet Norcota or Gold Rush are common cultivars that we see for the fresh market. In that space, reds are still popular. But what's gaining are sales of yellows, right? And so sort of mid-sized or sort of creamer-sized yellows or mixes, right? Where you get smaller potatoes that might be yellow, purple, red in a blend. And those types of smaller potatoes are continuing to gain in popularity. And some of the reasoning there is that they're easier to prepare. They take less time to cook up when families are busy. And so we do see those varieties taking a bit more of a lead in the marketplace. But here in our state, we also have substantial commercial production for round white potatoes to make chips, right? So mm-hmm. There are a lot of growers that contract with potato chippers. And so in my work in dealing with a commercial setting, we have many calls at times for questions in the chip variety space.
Yeah. Let's think about home growers. You know, I was...
Yeah.
Did you see the movie The Martian?
I did see it.
And that was a fun movie because Matt Damon, as I think is Mark Watney or something like that, was stuck on Mars, but he had some potatoes. And so that's how he lived, by growing potatoes on Mars, so to speak. And if you can grow them on Mars, I guess we can grow them here in Wisconsin, and we do grow a lot. A lot
of them. Much more hospitable conditions, yes.
Much more hospitable. How easy is it to grow potatoes?
It's in our part of the country, it is easier. So potatoes do like cooler weather, and so we have some of that here. They like fertile soil, slightly acidic soils between 5.8 and 6.5 pH. at time of planting, they like to see 45 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit in our soils. And we typically see this in mid to late April. Some home gardeners like to wait until May. In fact, some even wait until June before planting potatoes. And that can be a way of avoiding things like Colorado potato beetles that may come and chew on the foliage. But we also have good and by and large, the natural soils of our state, we do see good drainage, which is important for potato production. And so if you do get seeds from a garden center and the varieties may vary, they may sell a red types. I heard, you know, Pontiac was brought forward earlier. You could see red Norlands here in this space. And there are about a dozen other cultivars that often will show up in the garden center places. There you also see some yellows, often Yukon Gold is one that might appear. There are a number of other newer yellow varieties that are in the market space as well. And then typically some russets or a round white type. So those cultivars may vary, but you'll see those out on shelves. But it's important to observe those well, right? And so through our seed certification process, we do our best to send out the best for commercial sales. But what you're buying, have a look at it. If anything is soft or squishy or wet looking, and then use your nose. If it smells off, it may mean that you do have a soft rotting bacterium that's starting to do some work in those seed potatoes. But look for potato tubers that are that are dry, that are not soft, they're firm. And if it looks like a good potato that you would eat, it's probably a good potato to plant, right? Okay. So be mindful of that. But good conditions for planting in our state, where we have more than 6 hours of daylight is what all you need, and temperatures above 45 at night and 55 and higher during the day for production. And we're in a good position here in Wisconsin for potato production.
Mary shot us an email to ask if it's normal for there to be extreme sizes of potatoes on one plant. She gets a couple huge, medium, and small. She'll get few big ones, she'll get medium ones, she'll get small ones on her plants. And if this is not normal, what should she be doing?
Yeah, it is normal. So some varieties are determinate and some are indeterminate. And so that means some potato plant will just continue to set new tubers. And so some will size up as new potatoes are setting on. And others will sort of make one set of potatoes and then they all get bigger over time as a group. And so in that case, you would see less differentiation between the sizes. But yes, that does happen as growing conditions can change. I know last summer, we'd have one month that was the wettest, coolest, and then another month where it was hottest, driest. And those conditions are a bit rough on potatoes. And so I like to say that potato tubers have a great memory, like elephants, right? They seem to hang on to that weather and we see them responding, and sometimes they respond even later than the occurrence of that weather. But when it comes to tubers, yes, as those plants are sending resources to the potato tubers to size up or to bulk, as we call it, that can vary with the prevailing environmental conditions that we're experiencing and the health of the plant. And so maintaining good watering schedule and a nutritional or a feed schedule for those plants is important. Potato plants do use a lot of fertility in their production to make potatoes. And so, making sure you're providing them with an adequate amount of fertility and water is important for them to produce more consistently.
Jean from Milwaukee emailed, she saw something about using stacked milk crates for growing potatoes. You know anything about this method?
Yeah, not specifically about that. I've heard of stacked old tires and all other kinds of container systems, but I think you can grow potatoes in anything, right? So I think the system, as long as, again, you have good drainage and a good depth. So when you plant seed potatoes, whether it's a whole potato or you cut it into pieces, You'll want to make sure they're about 4 to 6 inches deep in the soil. And then once that plant starts to form, be sure that whatever that system is, there's enough room where you can make a hill or a mound of soil over the top of that plant. And that will help. Again, it helps produce tubers that then don't have exposure to the sunlight, which will turn them green. But also make sure you have enough space. So the tubers typically set on right underneath the plant itself and downward in that hill. And so if there's any limitation in soil space that's underneath that plant, they need at least a foot to 18 inches to set their tubers. They can kind of position them, and they tend to position tubers and the true roots right around the water supply. So it tends to be right underneath the base of that plant. But yeah, as long as it is a large enough volume to accommodate the tubers produced and enough size so you can create that little hill above the planting, it sounds like the system could work.
Yeah. Had someone on the show who talked about it, used a chicken wire and made a fairly large tube and filled it with, forget what they filled it with, materials. But anyway, then planted the potatoes, and then in the fall, they just unhooked the chicken wire, and of course it all falls down, and there's your potatoes.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you one that I did. I had the 1 year I had quite a bit of leftover from my straw and alfalfa from my straw bale garden, so I had a big pile of it. So I just piled it up. I got my seed potatoes. I opened up a little spot with my hands and around that mound, and I had a great crop of potatoes that year.
I bet.
So
yeah, they're resourceful. The potatoes will find what they need, and sometimes they'll grow even where and when you don't want them to grow, right?
Yeah. Oh, man. Paul in Boyceville emailed to say, you said that potatoes prefer a more basic soil pH. In that light, would one want to raise the pH in acidic soil, not lower it, as stated? Maybe you could clear that up. What's a good what's a good growing range?
Sure. I'm sorry if I misspoke. So the growing range is about 5.8 to 6.5 for ideal conditions. When trying to manage disease, there are times we try to make that soil a bit more acidic to try to reduce disease. And so, then going lower than 5.8, often growers will try to target like 5.5 or 5.2 sometimes in order to get out of the risk of common scab disease. But there, we do have some soils in the state where the pHs are much higher, and they might be closer to 8. And under those conditions, again, we try to bring that pH down to the range that's optimum for potato, which is 5.8 to about 6.5. But sometimes we do take that range lower than what is really optimum for potato to try to enhance management of a disease.
Helen in Duluth, Minnesota has a question, I believe, or maybe a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I heard you talk about what I call the potato towers, and
yeah.
I actually tried those this past summer.
How'd it go?
It went fairly well. I think I would tweak it if I do it again. As far as space, I don't have a space constraint, but for somebody with a small garden, they would be great. They're a little unwieldy to work with because, especially once the soil is wet, they're heavy. But that's mainly when you're starting out. They were very stable. I was concerned about wind because we get some wind shear sometimes up here, and they didn't move. I found that depending on the spot, if they were getting too much sun, the potatoes more to the north and east did better on those towers, and the ones that maybe had a little tree shade did better on the south and west sides, and it all kind of evened out, so I really like that.
Helen, thanks. A comment, Amanda.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. I think with these systems, so much of it is about what works for you and your location. And like say the plants themselves, they can be quite resilient and grow as long as they have appropriate soil and space. And it sounds like, yeah, if you've learned to maybe optimize where these can function best on your in your space. But yeah, certainly the lighting and the way that your plant or the positioning of that plant to receive, whether it's prevailing air movement and wind or lighting, can be really critical. And in my field of pathology, we often look for ways of optimizing that sunshine on the plants, because shading, particularly in potato, can often lead to more foliar disease. And we do have a number of foliar pathogens that we see onset in potato plants in both home gardens as well as commercial fields. And so, in fact, when we're looking to scout a field for diseases, we often first visit a shady edge along a forested area or a tree line. So keeping your plants out in the open where they receive more full sun does help keep disease down in potato.
Thanks, Helen. I appreciate that call. Diana in Baraboo emailed. She grew up hearing that you're supposed to plant your potatoes on Good Friday. Obviously, that doesn't make much sense because Good Friday varies from the end of March to mid-April. Do you know anything about the reason for this old-time advice? She wonders.
Yeah, it's a great question. I am always fascinated by sort of what rules dictate planting times and dates across the regions I've worked in over the years. But yeah, I mean, generally, the recommendation is to wait until about your 2 to 4 weeks before your last average risk of frost, right? And so there's quite a range in there. The one thing I will say about potatoes is that they catch up. Right. So with planting dates, commercially, we see farmers go out and plant as early as sometimes the first week in April. There's no snow and ice and it's sunshine. They'll go out and make hay, as they say. But they'll also plant all the way through until sometimes middle of May or late May. And that just gives, it's betting, hedge betting, right? Because there may be a better date than others. But a lot of what goes into that too is the varieties that you're choosing and your goal of planting those potatoes, right? So for a home gardener, I think it's best to actually wait a little bit and plant a little bit later. That does get you out of any risk of frost. And potato plants will grow back even if they are hit with a frost. They keep their energy up and they will sprout again, but it does set them back, and it could set them back a couple of weeks. So it's best to just wait a little bit till the soil is more reliably and consistently warm and moist to plant. But yeah, that starting point, I think, just is sometimes it's rule of thumb, but we really just need to make sure we're getting the plants out or the seed out when we have most consistent warm soil.
Liz in Madison emailed, they're having a hard time thinking of the potato as a vegetable in some ways. They're delicious, fried, baked, hashed, etc. But how do they compare nutrition-wise to other vegetables? Maybe a carrot or a broccoli or whatever.
Oh, it's a great question. Yeah, as a vegetable, it is quite nutritive. There's lots of potassium in a potato. In fact, I think depending on the size of the potato, it competes with the banana, which we all, I think, quite know and popularized as a high potassium piece of fruit. But it has vitamin C, calcium, and so it certainly is a nutritionally packed potato tuber and one that has real nutritional value as well as fiber.
Another question from John, wondering about the best way to store potatoes. And I think in his case, he puts them in a refrigerator when he buys a bag of them. Is that a good thing to do for short term?
Yeah, for short term, it would be fine. They will last a long time in refrigeration. To maintain the sort of optimum quality and flavor, a dark cool place like a basement or a cellar is, or a closet can be even better. But of course, the warmer you go closer to room temperature, that lifespan or shelf span will be reduced. But refrigeration, certainly they will keep a long time in the fridge. The sugars change. So the way that potato might taste, if you are a connoisseur of potatoes, you might taste a difference. I know when I store potatoes in the refrigerator, you can notice that they'll be a little sweeter, sort of a cold induced sweetening that happens. Those are careful measures that our chippers and fryers do take note of, because that changes the color of the fries and the chips if the tubers are too cold. And so that's just a trait that you will notice in storing them at home. If they're colder, they might taste a little sweeter, but they'll store a long time in that refrigerator for you.
Grant emailed, he discovered a local potato he loves. It's called Prairie Red, grown by a local farmer, but was developed at UW-Madison. The grower advises he shouldn't wash them or any types of potatoes until he's ready to cook them. He says it'll keep better stored that way. Would you agree with that?
That is true. When once you introduce water to that potato tuber and wash it, if you keep it out on a kitchen countertop or in a pantry, it will have less of a lifespan, because that moisture can set on some soft rotting bacteria, for example, that'll break it down. So it is best to keep the soil associated with the tubers, keep them dark and cool, and that is the best storage. Once they're washed, if you're refrigerating them, then that kind of that cool temperature of the refrigerator at 4°C is enough. It will maintain it longer, but the quality will be maintained best if you keep the soil on the tuber.
And how do you know when it's time to harvest your potatoes that you've got growing outside?
Great question. It depends what you want. So if you want what is called a new potato, those are the smaller potatoes that if you harvest early, you'll find, if you scratch the skin surface with your thumbnail, it'll rub right off, right? And those are new potatoes. They're not to be stored. They don't store very long. They tend to have a slightly different flavor, a little bit more earthy or metallic, some people will say. And some people really like that. And so they'll dig their potatoes early to get those qualities. If you leave them in the soil longer to their maturity, then the skin will set and it's much firmer. It's harder to rub it off. And those are the tubers that then you can take and store a bit longer. But that changes the taste a little bit and the storability duration. So it just depends what you want from your potatoes. But if you want to store them over the winter, then certainly you want to leave them in the ground until the tops naturally senesce. Or you might push that senescence by cutting off the tops of the plants at some point in September or so. And then those tubers that skin will kind of finish off under the ground for about a week to two after those tops are dead. And then that will give you potatoes that should store well through your fall and winter.
And on that happy note, Amanda, thank you so much for being with us today. It was a real treat. I hope we can do this again. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Amanda Gevins, chair of the Department of Plant Pathology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, our guest today. Fun talking with her about potatoes. And coming up next, we're going to talk about soil. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News. Great to have you along for Garden Talk today. You know, as gardeners, we tend to focus on what's above the ground and not the soil or plants not the soil or plants live in. Next up, we're going to talk about why soil is so important with our guest. Bryant Scherenbrock is an associate professor of soil science in the Soil and Waste Resources Department of the College of Natural Resources at the UW Stevens Point. So we'll talk with him about soil. Bryant Scherenbrock, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on. I listen to the show quite regularly, and I'm really happy to be on and talk a little bit about soils.
Well, I tell you what, as a matter of fact, it was great. You sent us an email and said, you know, we're in your experience, gardeners forget often about soil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they sure do. I think it tends to be one of these very important subjects, but also quite complex. But there are a lot of, you know, simple things that we can do to manage soil quality and work with the soils to help grow our plants and also provide and support the other functions that soils also give us.
So, you know, let's get everybody started on the same page. How do you define soil?
Oh, that's a great question. So first off, I would say that soil is not dirt. So I do distinguish soil from dirt. And there's some things that I think are important when we consider a definition of soil. First is that it's a natural living being. It's composed of organic matter, but it also has this mineral component of sand, silt, and clay. It has air, it has water. It is very complex, which is another thing that I use to define it. It has physical, chemical, and biological properties. And all of these things are working together to provide very important functions for us, like water storage and cleaning, like a habitat for soil organisms, even the plant, the buildings and infrastructure. It recycles all of our waste. It modifies our atmosphere. And of course, we grow our plants in it. And that's probably the most relevant for your audience. Other things when we think about a definition of soil that I point out is it's really the interface between all of the water, the air, the rocks, and the living organisms on our planet. And it's not just this static interface, it's dynamic, meaning that it changes over time, it changes across space, it changes with depth. And then the last thing I always like to emphasize this in a definition of soil is that it's fragile. I think that's something that folks will forget. You know, it's underneath our feet. We're walking on it all the time. And we think it's this resource that we can do whatever to, and it's just going to continue providing the services, but that's really not the case. We can damage soil quality in a matter of seconds by driving on it at the wrong time. And that can take thousands of years to repair. So that's my definition. So I know it's a little bit long-winded, but it's definitely not dirt.
So what's dirt?
So for me, it really depends on the person. So for me, there's very few things I would consider dirt, but dirt is more of a nuisance. So even the stuff that's underneath my fingernails, I appreciate it supporting life. I don't mind it. I consider the distinction being something that's a nuisance.
How'd you get interested in soil, by the way?
So I started off as more of a plant person. I still am a plant person. I have degrees in forestry and I study tree and soil interactions, but I started digging some soil pits and looking at soils, particularly this was up in the upper Michigan underneath some of those old growth forests, northern hardwood hemlocks, and saw these spectacular soil horizons where they have this accumulation of iron and aluminum, and so much so that it cements up, and then so much that cementing works with the forest and creating these restrictive layers, and that works to make the trees tip over. And this really cool, complex feedback loop was kind of presented to me, and after that, I was hooked. I just can't stop digging holes. I dig them all the time. And yeah, every time you dig a hole, you get to go back thousands and sometimes even millions of years in history and really put together the landscape. So it's just amazing for me.
As you were talking about that and your definition of soil, I was thinking of a great soil scientist from the University of Wisconsin, Francis Hole.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And he would teach his classes. He'd take his violin to his class.
Would, yep.
And so this is what sandy soil sounds like. And this is what Adigo silt loam sounds like. And just the varying notes and tones within the music kind of gives you, as you were explaining that, I was thinking about his playing and how that kind of worked for me.
Yeah. I don't know, Larry, do you know the Antigo song? So Francis came up with the state soil song, which is the Antigo song. And it's a beautiful song, but yeah. Y'all should Google it if you don't.
His home, actually, where he lived his life here at the UW, he's passed, of course, along a bit, is only a block behind my own house. So I walk by it pretty much every day and think about him. He was a pretty cool guy. So the plants we put into it, it's so important to the plants we put into it, and depending on the soil itself, it makes a difference to the plants that you want to put in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the principles of soil management, and this is probably the most important principle in my opinion, is this idea of the right plant for the right soil. There's thousands and thousands of different types of soils out there. And there's also thousands and thousands of different types of plants with all different tolerances for different soil conditions. And you know, oftentimes soil management is focused on like, what can we do to fix the soil and fix in quotation marks. But, you know, another approach we could take is, what can we do to match the plants with the existing soil conditions? And we can learn a lot about this just by looking at the natural plant communities and looking at and studying the soils that are associated with these natural plant communities, and then try to mimic these soils for the target plants. So, for example, if I want to grow a red pine forest, you know, I know that I would want maybe a sandy, more acidic soil compared to if I was going to grow a forest with sugar maple. Maybe I want to do some syruping. Well, then I would maybe want to have a more fine textured soil, a layer with maybe some clay accumulation, a little bit more fertility. So I think a lot can be done by understanding the plant and soil relationships.
Yeah. A lot of that came up in our segment of our program with Neil DeBoe. Many people were talking. Yeah. Neil was quick to point out if people ask if people had what kind of soil they had, and they'd give kind of a description, and then he would sometimes disagree with them based on what they said. But mostly he would say, well, you can't grow these plants here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I was listening along. It was excellent. I particularly like some of the recommendations about some of those wet, more fine textured soils and plants like sensitive fern. That's just excellent advice. I mean, why work against these soil conditions? Instead, we can embrace the plants that are going to really succeed in those environments.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian Scherenbrock, our guest today, Associate Professor of Soil Science at UW Stevens Point. We're talking about soils and plants and their relationships. Maybe you've got a question, maybe about plants that might or might not work in your soil, or maybe you have a question about the soil itself, or a little more about an individual type of soil that you do have. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News and Garden Talk.
Antigo, a soil to know, Wisconsin's crops and livestock grow, and forest too on Antigo, and forest too on Antigo. Great Lakes region, fertile land, glaciers spread both clay and sand. Blue silt, then forest grew, giving soils their brownish hue.
Talking soil and the plants and their relationship with our guest, Brian Scherenbrock, Associate Professor of Soil Science at UW Stevens Point. Great to have him with us. Let's talk about finding out about your soil. There are, you know, probably what's the best way for the average person to find out about their soil?
Oh, yeah. So how can you tell if your soil is good, bad, or somewhere in between? I think you want to start with first, what are you using your soil for? There's many different functions that soils perform. Are you growing corn on it? Is it a forest soil? Are you using it for a septic system? So that will define a little bit about some of the indicators that you would focus in on, these kind of clues that'll tell you about soil quality. I think for your audience, you're mostly going to be interested in growing plants and garden plants in particular. So there are a handful of physical, chemical, and biological indicators that folks will look for soil quality for these purposes. So for example, looking at the soil structure, and those are these little clumps of soil, how the sand, silt, clay, and organic matter are held together. And that's one of my favorite indicators. And what you're looking for is this crumbly granular structure that looks like a bunch of BBs all the way to marbles. And that's there because of the high organic matter and essentially the gluing of the sand, silt, and clay together in those little balls. And that indicates a lot of biological activity, both in plants and microorganisms. And that's ideal because it's going to allow for the water to drain out of the soil and also the water to be held in the soil. So that's a really great physical indicator. An example of a biological indicator, organic matter is so important for soil quality. So if we can look at the soil to assess how much organic matter is in it, if it has a dark color, if it has that organic smell compared to like an anaerobic or sour smell, if it has that sort of, I always say like a 70% chocolate bar color. That's kind of what we're looking for, that brownish color. And then, of course, you know, the plants growing in there, you don't forget about them. They're living in that environment. So if you see great, vigorous plant growth, that's one of our best indicators of soil quality. Other animals like earthworms and fungi. And sometimes we have chemical indicators. Those tend to be a little bit more difficult to assess. And oftentimes folks will collect soil samples and then send them off a laboratory for that. But there are some simple tests like assessing the soil pH, which you can do from things like garden kits, that can give you some loose approximations about your soil acidity, alkalinity.
We have Dean in Iron River with a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dean. Thank you for calling. Dean, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon. I had a question. I'm growing pumpkins up in Iron River. I'm just wondering, somebody told me like pumpkins grow better in like a sandier content soil, or I don't know what that means, but was wondering if you had anything to say about that.
I don't know a lot about pumpkins in particular and soil preferences. What kind of soil do you have? Are you aware? Is it more of a sandy soil?
It's not very sandy. It's very thick. It's right near like a wetland, and okay. It's been farmed for decades by my father, but I've taken it over. And so it's sort of very moist, low. I don't know how to talk about.
Yeah. Have you tried growing pumpkins on it so far?
I have. And I've gotten a pretty good crop this year. I'm just wondering whether or not I can make it better. And so
they do prefer a more drained soil, which is why folks will say the sandier soils. And if you do have a higher water table, one of the things that you could look to do is maybe mound it up a little bit. So take some of that soil and create, a one, two, 3 foot mound. That's actually how I grow my pumpkins as well, too, just because of that drainage issue. You could add a little bit of organic matter if your soil looks light in color. Applying a little compost might be a good strategy for that.
Yeah, for sure. But I like the idea of hilling for sure. That will make a difference, I would think, Dean. Mm-hmm. Give it a shot. Let's go to Karen in Black River. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have a barnyard area, and I have this one area where it has had a lot of manure on it in past years, but it's been a while. The soil is just super dark, rich black, but it's a pretty big section, maybe 20 by 30, and it's wet all the time, like constantly. I'm just wondering if
a way to figure out if there's a spring or something underneath there? How would I?
So how would you go about determining if there's an aqua, a spring or something under that area? Is that your question, Karen?
Yeah. Like, who do I even call about that?
When you look outside of the manure affected area, what does that area look like?
Oh, that's just all dry and sandy, and
yep.
The rest of the barnyard's all nice and clean and sandy, and yeah. And there hasn't been manure on that area for many years, mm-hmm. but it's just and every place else is dry.
Yep.
The horses are up on a hill, so I have fantastic drainage. And it yep. doesn't always get the best sun to dry it out, but it gets enough that it should not be wet, like
sure.
every single day, every single year.
Yeah. So organic matter is really great, but when you have so much, it really holds on to water. And if what you're describing sounds to me like you just have a lot of manure in that particular soil. One thing I would suggest doing is, you know, when you expose organic matter to the air, it'll start to decompose. And you could till that area, and that will work to oxidize some of that organic matter. And then over time, it would probably become, it would reduce the water holding capacity and dry it out a little bit. That's what I would try to start with. You might even just dig in with a shovel to see how deep it is, because if it's, you know, we're talking about really thick organic horizons that are 2-3 feet deep, that might take a little bit more work to do what I'm describing.
Yeah. So get the shovel out and see. And so if it's a foot or less, Brian?
Yep. I think you could till that up. And you might have to hit it a couple times, but then it would work to decompose that.
All right. There you go, Karen. Thank you so much for calling. Jonathan in Fitchburg has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello. So this might be a really technical question. I've been reading a lot about microplastics and, you know, how they're working their way into us via our food and the environment in general. And I was curious if that's something that you're studying with soils and if it's getting to us through our food that we grow in soil, or if that's not really something that, not that we need to worry about, or if it's just not an issue with plants as much as it is with, you know, like fish have tons of microplastics.
Yeah,
that's a great question. So microplastics would fall into categories of these sort of toxic things that we can be exposed to, either directly or indirectly through soils and plants. And folks are studying it. It's a relatively new area of study in soil science, obviously, because it's a relatively new sort of issue in our society. And they are studying things like, are these things being taken up into plants? Are they decomposing? If they're decomposing, what sort of organisms are involved in their decomposition? And then where are these products going? Are they going into our waters and to our wherever they're ending up? It's not something that I myself am studying. I study urban soils and I study more the toxins. I focus in on are heavy metals, and we started studying a little bit on PFAS as well too. So I can't speak towards the specifics on it other than to say that folks are definitely looking into it and it's research that's happening.
All right, Jonathan, thank you so much for calling. Jan in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Last year in the fall, I put down cardboard on my vegetable garden and put on a layer of about 6 inches of lasagna guarding, primarily fresh vegetable scraps. And I did not see a noticeable improvement this summer, and I was wondering would it be better to put down a couple of inches of manure, composted manure across the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Brian?
Yeah, can I ask what are you growing? What plants are you trying to target?
Crucifers mostly in that area.
Okay.
And have you looked at your soil prior to? Did it have a topsoil horizon that was darker in color? And if it did, how big was that?
I have some of the best soil in Viroqua. It used to be a cattle farm.
Yeah.
So I have really good, and it's been organic for over 20 years.
Oh, excellent. So the cardboard, you know, that's for weeds. And I'm assuming you were able to take care of the weeds with that and you don't have a problem with that. The addition of the manure, I mean, I don't, from what you're describing, it doesn't sound like that might be necessary because you have such a high organic matter soil already. I look at organic matter management a little bit like you would do your checkbook. Consider like the outputs, and that would be the nutrients that are associated with the plants that are being taken out, and the inputs would be like my income and the incoming organic matter that might be the plants left on site, or if we do had to add something to it. And it sounds like you have a pretty big balance in your checkbook already, so you might not need to add a lot of organic matter until you start depleting it.
So do a little depleting before you do a little adding there.
Maybe because if you keep adding it, you could run into a situation like the previous or a couple callers ago where you have this really high organic matter that can hold on to a little bit too much water, maybe not as strong as a medium in terms of its support. So we want to target about 5 to 10% maximum organic matter in most mineral soils for plants.
Thinking about that, Lori emailed that she has jumping worms and they left the soil looking like coffee grounds and hard to get rid of the worms. Anything she can do to improve the soil, of course, if you do that, you just keep the worms coming.
The worms, the jumping worms and the night crawlers, boy, that's an issue that we have in some of our Wisconsin forests and even some of our managed areas now. They really rip through that organic matter layer. There's some active research looking at things like charcoal, and because they can be irritants for the earthworms. I would certainly continue to add the organic matter because you don't want that all depleted. One thing, if it's not a really large area, you can use extractants. So one of the ways that we study earthworms is by using mustard powder. So we mix up mustard powder with water and we pour that on soil. And it's an irritant for their skin, but it's not a very dangerous one for the environment. And they'll come up and then you could gather them physically and remove them from a site if it's not a large area. Other ways that you can get them out of the soil is vibrations. So sounding rods folks will put in the ground and pound it and put them up or gather them on wet periods. So if it's a large area, then that's a different story. It's really hard to get them out. Yeah.
It is indeed. I like that mustard idea though. I hadn't heard that.
Oh yeah. It's cool. When we teach kids about soil quality, earthworms are so charismatic. And when a bunch of kids are standing around, we pour some mustard liquid on a soil and they see all the worms coming up. Oh, they go crazy. And so do the adults, especially the soil scientist adults like myself.
And you're talking about dry mustard like we got in our kitchens.
Oh, yeah. You want to get it's better to use the spicier, the better. It's the compound, the glucosinolate in the mustard powder itself is the irritant.
Yeah. Well, this has been interesting and fun, Brian. I thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Maybe we can do this again down the road. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. I'd love to do it again and appreciate the time. And thank you for having me on the show.
Our guest, Brian Scherenbrock. And I tell you what, I think our technical director today, Jeff Robbins, dug up a copy of the Antigo Silt Loam song, so we can go out on that. I want to thank you all for listening. Brian, of course, again, associate professor at UW-Stevens Point in the Department of Soil Science. Great to have him with us. And I mentioned, along with Jeff Robbins, Lee Rayburn's our other technical director, Clara Neiper, Joel Patnut, our producers, Jill Nadeau, our executive producer, our director, and I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and let's listen to a couple of seconds of the Antigo Silt Loam song.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy goes, so you know Wisconsin's crops and livestock grow. And forest too on Nancy go, and forest too on Nancy go.